Hey everyone, you're listening to the Learn Swift podcast. I'm your host, Steven. And on today's episode, I have Joe Fabisevich. He is an iOS developer at Twitter, just started there very recently. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's really nice to talk to you.
Yeah, so we've actually kind of talked back and forth a little bit. You got in touch with me after you heard Mark Opont's last episode, and I think you listened to David Okun's as well, and we kind of started chit-chatting from there. And you had expressed interest in being on the show, but you know, schedules and like all the stuff, especially I think with you interviewing and stuff, which eventually led to you getting the job at Twitter, I think, and then finally we're able to get you on the show.
Yeah, no, I was really excited after hearing Mark's interview. It's pretty funny because Mark lives a few miles away from me, but the only time I ever see him is when we go 3,000 miles to a conference. And so, yeah, I decided I would try and get his attention this way.
Yeah, Mark's a great guy. Every time I talk to him, he's just really really relatable guy. Like I don't think I've ever heard anybody say, "Oh yeah, that Mark guy, I can't relate to him at all."
Yeah, no, he's very upbeat and very cheery, and it's very nice to know.
Yeah. So, when you were interviewing, what was your, cause you've been doing iOS development for a while. And before we actually get into that, let's just kind of back up and tell everyone your background. Cause you've been doing iOS for a very long time. So yeah, just go ahead and let everybody know who you are, what you've been up to, and what led you to here.
Yeah, sure. So I've been doing iOS since just after the App Store launched, actually. I was in college, and I actually was a computer science major, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was very lazy as a kid, and I was just like, this is the only thing that I do that is somewhat even interesting to me. And then the iPhone came out, and I finally had something that was relatable to me, where I was like, oh, I actually want to make an app for this platform. And I ended up building with my friend a map that generated heat maps for baseball players from the strike zone. So it could show you how well a player performed on high strikes or low balls or anything like that, and anything in between. And it was the first time that I saw programming as a way to actually express myself. And I built about maybe 60% of the app and used that as a way to talk my way into an internship building a browser that did server-side filtering for schools and libraries to prevent, you know, kids from going to like gambling sites and things like that. And since I had even 60% of an app at the time when the App Store was just launching, that was more experience than pretty much anything that anyone could find. And then by the time I was out of school, I had about 2 years of experience doing iOS, and that led me to my first full-time job doing iOS, since, again, the same kind of market dynamics applied where it was hard to find iOS developers, even harder than it is today. And yeah, so ever since then, I've been working at startups, mostly early stage startups, everything from working at a Techstars company to founding a startup to, you know, working most recently. My last full-time job was at TimeHop, the app that shows you this day on history. And then the last 2.5 years or so, I've been consulting and helping companies that are at early stage either figure out what their mobile kind of initiative is going to be, you know, taking a product that is built on the web. One client I had was Teachable, and they have a very web-centric experience, but then realized that supporting offline support and doing things in a mobile-friendly way was also something that was crucial to their business. And another early-stage startup, a women's health startup called Tia, basically going from, you know, words and napkin sketches to an app in the App Store in 6 months, to helping them raise a round and all of that kind of stuff. And now I decided to go back to full-time, and I guess after about 8 or 9 years, come back around to that.
So I've always been curious about consulting work and what it's like to, like, you know, you obviously need to have experience. I don't expect anyone to think that they can go from like not really having any experience to jump into consulting, at least on that scale anyway. You know, maybe local businesses or whatever, smaller businesses, mm-hmm. maybe want something and you can approach them that way. But this is on a completely different scale that you're doing it. What's it like? Did you have contacts? Like, how did you market yourself? Like what kind of things did you do to actually start engaging in these kinds of projects?
Sure. Yeah. Network is everything when it comes to consulting. I leaned on friends for opportunities. I leaned on people who, you know, I always believe in giving back to the community, and it becomes reciprocal. When you give back, people then have opportunities that they want to pass along to you. And so unintentionally, I built up a network that came in handy quite a bit. And so more directly, I went to founders than specifically other iOS developers, because founders are always interacting with other founders who are looking to start something. And, you know, I follow up on pretty much every lead, and 8, 9 out of 10 of them are not going to be worth the time if you look at it as just, am I getting work out of this? But on the other end, there are people who are looking to have their problem solved. And that's always been really fun for me, and not just coding. And so I was able to take that experience and say, oh, you know, I was able to help this person figure this out. And that helped me when I was actually trying to solve a problem as a developer, as a consultant, to use that sort of pseudo lived experience and offer that up as a service.
That's pretty, that's pretty cool. I've always wondered about the process and what people go through. And I figured it mostly had something to do with, you know, the personal network. And I think that that's kind of a, when people say network, I feel like, or when people say that they want to network, it kind of feels a little self-serving as like a merely transactional relationship. So it always feels like, and I know that's exactly not how you meant it. You said an unintentional network, essentially. But that's how you have to look at it. In my opinion, every network that most of my network isn't in iOS or whatever, professionally anyway. You know, I've got a lot of contacts in oil and gas and stuff like that. So I could probably go back to that industry if I wanted to, because it's starting to pick back up. But it's kind of like in the rearview mirror at this point. So right now, but looking back then, you know, I wasn't intentionally like trying to get those people to end up giving me opportunities. Yeah. Right. It's just like, you know, hey, Steve, you want to come back and work for our team at this company? It's like, I appreciate it, but no, not really. I'm trying to shift into another direction right now.
I do think it's really important to make sure that you're doing it not to be self-serving, because otherwise that will definitely show through. And the other thing is that any experience that you do take on becomes a part of you. And so actually going out there and building things, not just networking, is also really important. So either building an app on your own, so that way you can go from nothing to ending up in the App Store, going through that whole process. If that's the kind of consulting work that you're going to be doing, then it's really important to, even on a small scale, be able to do that. So that way you can extrapolate that out into what a client will actually need. So that way you can say, I've done this before. I feel confident in my ability to do it. Because especially when you're charging, I charge by the hour, there is a natural weight of saying, I want to do this as fast for you. So that way you feel that you got your money's worth, rather than the usual relationship that's associated with contractors, which is they're trying to spend as many hours as possible. So that way they can charge as much. But at least the way that I believe it to be is that if you go in with the good intention of doing it as fast as you can, that will pay off in the long run, as you'll get referrals, as you'll get people coming back to you and saying, I would like some more help. Or just, you know, it, for me at least, it's hard to live with myself thinking that I'm trying to pull a fast one on someone else.
Yeah, I couldn't feel good about myself if doing anything like that. I think it's really just, I think it just takes a totally different person to feel like they want to do that. Cause I feel like they would probably just be trying to rip people off in anything that they do. And it's probably not specific to contractors in general. Have you had any interesting pushback from clients when it comes to billable hours? Like, have you ever had any questions of like, why did this take you like the length of time? Like, no, nobody can perfectly estimate a particular the length of time something's going to take.
Sure.
Have you ever had any pushback from like, why did this take you 15 hours when you said it would take five?
So I'm going to answer that a little differently. It actually usually happens at the beginning when it's very hard to estimate the scope of the work. Very frequently, people will say, oh, I can't believe this will take 3 months. And I have to kind of walk them through why something will take 3 months rather than telling them, oh, this took 15 hours and, you know, we expected it to take five. A lot of the people that I choose to work with have a pretty good understanding of software and understand that it is a process and that it is imperfect in a lot of ways. So personally, I say that here is the best case scenario, here is the worst case scenario, and very likely it will end up closer to the worst case than the best case. And they're setting their expectations in that way usually leaves them pretty happy because it very rarely is the worst case. But when it is the worst case, they have the framing of knowing that it could take that long. And so it's very rare to get pushback in the middle of a project. At the end of a project, though, very frequently, people will say, I thought that this would look this way. And I have to explain to them, well, if you want it to look this way, then we can work together and get it to work, look this way. But at the same time, it's going to take another week, another 2 weeks, and then explain to them what the benefits are and what the cons are. And very frequently, they come to a decision that I would personally agree with. And I'm happy about that in the sense that I let them make the decision rather than choosing for them. And I think that ultimately that's my job, is to inform them of all the potential ideas and trade-offs that are there, and then let them choose, because it's their company. As much as I want to help them accomplish their vision, it's their vision that is there to be accomplished.
Yeah, that makes total. I mean, that's like when you go to buy a car and then somebody's trying to sell you a totally different car. And essentially, it's like, no, I know you that you think you want this, but you really want this. And it's like, no, that's not really what I want, though.
Right. And if someone actually told you, well, what you're saying is you want to go 0 to 60 in 6 seconds, then that's why you want this car, then it would make more sense as to why they're upselling you or, you know, selling you something somewhat related and telling you, well, this is what you told me about what you want, rather than saying, no, what you need is a Ford Taurus.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. So shifting from consulting and whatnot, and what made you decide to go from, you know, deciding that consulting was no longer something that you really wanted to do to getting a full-time job again? Was it more or less you wanted more stability, or that you just wanted a change of pace?
Sure. I've actually found contracting to be very stable. I've usually had more inbound leads than I have had time to take them on. And so it really wasn't a problem with that. And I'm actually really happy with all the clients that I worked with. They're products that I really enjoyed working on, and usually, actually pretty much, were not morally ambiguous. And so that allowed me to not feel guilty about a very straightforward transaction of charging by the hour for a thing that I'm doing without kind of worrying about, I guess, the side effects of capitalism. And, you know, I was very happy with the work, and I was very happy that I was working less, having more time for my own personal stuff. But I did feel that I was missing a sense of purpose or vision in a lot of ways, where I was able to fulfill my own needs by myself as a result, but not feeling as fulfilled on the products that I was working on, even when they were doing something that I agreed with. And it felt important for me to actually take the time right now. I'm not saying that I won't ever go back to consulting. And in fact, it's a distinct possibility. But right now, and for the foreseeable future, I really want to work on something that I care about, that I believe is meaningful. And as I start to delve more into, I guess, the philosophical aspects and the ethical aspects of technology, seeing that not everything is black and white, having exposure to something that is not fully black and white, that is a ton of gray area, and making it a little bit better, is something that I feel is a challenge that I'm really excited to take on.
That's pretty cool. Usually whenever you, and you know, I've only heard from a handful of different consultants, but you know, they say feast or famine, but that's pretty cool that you had a very steady stream. I guess it's just all in who you know, and you know, your reputation really, and what you're able to get from that. So another thing that I wanted to ask you about, 'cause I always hear about, people going to do interviews with larger companies or just companies in general, coming as a junior developer. How is that process different when you're more senior like yourself? You've been doing this since the App Store opened. So what is the perspective from the employer whenever they're interviewing you as a more senior guy?
You know, I don't know if I'm equipped to answer that. I think that what the employer is asking is not exactly, in my purview. I can tell you about the interview process that I went through at some of the bigger companies and some of the smaller companies, if that's something you'd rather hear.
Yeah. Just your experience in general, really. Not really anything specific. Like what kind of level of like questions, or is it like how does the process generally go? Because you had interviews when you were, I guess, a little more junior. But I guess when you started, really, I guess you had more experience than a lot of people. So I guess it's kind of hard to really say.
Yeah. So a lot of my earlier interviews were, I guess, talking my way into jobs more than it was proving algorithmic knowledge and things like that. So especially at early stage startups, they're not always looking for necessarily, and they are looking for strong developers, but people who are well-rounded. So I had experience with design by the time I was going into my first, my second or third interview, because it was something that was very interesting to me, and product. So in a lot of ways, I always felt that they're interviewing me, but I also have to be interviewing them, not only to figure out and how to assess the company, but also to show them that I'm not just an iOS developer who's going to be sitting there coding the iOS app all day, that I'm speaking on behalf of users, I'm working with the design team, and I've always really enjoyed the business side of things. So trying to figure out and explain to them, to the other side, that I understand their business and I want to be involved in figuring out how the iOS app affects that. And over time, as I've done less iOS too, from a backend perspective, working with those teams, and as I grow as a developer, I realize how many of the problems are more people-oriented than they are just pure code. Figuring out what's the right way to express that and gauge how a company feels about that.
Can you give an instance of where you would find something to be more people-oriented than it is code-oriented?
Definitely. So every time that you, as an iOS developer, are given an API, I think it's really important that you analyze that API and push back on where it is suboptimal, because these things tend to cascade. So you say, we'll make one exception here or make one exception there, and then all of a sudden you have three or four different kinds of representations of a very similar object. And they're used differently within the app. And that problem cascades to every developer who has to touch that, both on the back end and on the front ends. So it could be the web, it could be iOS, it could be Android. And so figuring out how to be a good communicator and figuring out what is the right way to express those concerns, especially considering that every person is different. And it's really important to make sure that people feel heard and don't feel hurt in the process. So I think that's a pretty canonical example that, as an iOS developer, people feel every day.
Yeah, I think tact is really important whenever you're constructive criticism is probably the best way to put it. Not sounding like a complete jerk or holier than thou whenever just talking to anybody about anything, really. But I would imagine, especially when it comes to code or an API surface, because people put a lot of hard work into that kind of stuff. And then if you kind of come at it from sounding like a jerk or coming off like a jerk, then probably you won't get a very good response.
Sure. Every time that you go into one of those discussions, it's really important to remember that there's a human being on the other end, the same way that you feel feelings, they're feeling feelings too. And every time that you undercut them or that you make them feel worse about themselves, is not only a thing that you're doing wrong in the moment, but you're lowering your own credibility and you're undercutting your own future self. So it's really important to remember and make sure that you treat the other people with the same respect that you wish to be treated with, because at some point you will be that person too.
Back again, sponsoring this week's episode is Lambda School. Lambda School is an online code school that trains students in various software engineering disciplines at no upfront cost to the student. Instead of paying tuition, students enter an agreement to pay Lambda School a percentage of their income for 2 years and only if their income is over $50,000 a year. In the event a student is unable to find a job after graduating, Lambda School never collects a penny. This incentivizes Lambda School to make sure that you have the skills needed to land a high-paying job. Lambda School's instructors have trained hundreds of iOS engineers and worked on iOS development curriculum directly for Apple. Lambda School is offering a free 2-week iOS 101 course with absolutely no strings attached. The June 11th cohort has already started, but you still have time to join the June 25th cohort operating on a Monday through Thursday schedule. Each day covers 1 hour of live instruction, an hour of practice problems with TAs available to answer any questions, and another hour of small group discussion around the problems. The cohort covers an introduction to Swift, the basics of Xcode and UIKit, and is a perfect way to see if Lambda School is the right fit for you. Listeners of the Learn Swift podcast can sign up for the free 2-week course at lambdaschool.com/learnswift. Thanks to Lambda School for sponsoring the show. So one of the things that I wanted to bring you on about was for you to talk about what you think is important for new developers or junior developers, however you want to frame it, what you think is important for them to know coming into, you know, this world of development.
Sure. So I'm going to take a second to shill out a newsletter that I write. It's actually a newsletter that is oriented towards more junior developers. It's articles that I come across that or I have come across in the past of information that I wish I knew when I was just starting out. So some of these are, you know, posts or essays that I read when I was a junior or a mid-level developer that didn't really click until I was senior. But either way, it's really important that I had that information in the back of my head because it really not only helped me to think about programming, but how to think like a programmer and how to think just more holistically about the processes and what we do in the day-to-day that ultimately consumes, you know, 8 hours a day, every day for years of our life. And so you can find the newsletter at bit.ly, and then /programming-newsletter. So bit.ly/programming-newsletter, and you can put it in the show notes. And it covers topics like computing history and ethics, and actually just some of it is actually programming and psychology and all these other things that have really shaped how I view it, which doesn't mean that it will shape how someone else views it, but the concepts are generally universally applicable. And so, you know, with the newsletter in mind, I think there's two or three things that I really wish that I had known earlier as a junior developer. I wish that I had studied computing history more because it's actually really relieving when you can. It turns out that computing history is not that old. It's only like 50 years old, really. But it is incredibly deep because the details are incredibly rich. But what happens is that when you understand the basic concept, if you start reading essays by like Edgar Dijkstra or Alan Kay or Donald Knuth, you notice that all the things that they're discussing are things that we're still discussing today, things that are sometimes core principles and sometimes reinvented as fads. And sometimes they're just things that you realize I don't have to wade into every discussion about every new framework or every new programming language because it's taking concepts that are already there and just kind of shuffling them around a little bit. So it's actually really, it's a big relief to be able to do that. And because it feels like there's almost a never-ending cascade of technology news. Technology is only moving faster. More languages are being invented, some domain specific and some general. And to really understand history is to gain that context for what is happening today.
I guess they always say history repeats itself. So definitely having a view of computing history would probably be helpful, especially in recognizing those patterns. I definitely need to look at computing history a little bit more. I'm familiar with computing history, like on the large scale of like, you know, how technology has progressed from like, you know, mainframes and tubes down to these tiny little microprocessors that are in our phones. But aside from that, though, as far as like I guess all the other stuff that you're talking about for the most part is something that I probably need to look at myself.
I actually think it's really cool that you can do that with regards to computers, where you can work your way down really deep into a subject. Like, you can go all the way back to the original roots of computing, back to like the Curry Howard correspondence, and then come back up and see where you are today and see its effects in everything. And then you can work your way back down on another subject. So it's not that important to understand everything right away. I don't understand everything, period. And be very okay with that. But as you start to learn more and more and more, you'll start to build a mental model and you'll start to really understand how these things interconnect with each other and how we got here today. And then whenever something new comes out, you'll be able to see the roots of that in whatever you've learned. So very recently, there's been a language that is starting to get a little traction called Reason ML. And it's very cool. It's built by Facebook. It's interesting. And what it does is actually take OCaml code and compile it down to JavaScript. And so you can build it compiles Reason to an intermediate language called BuckleScript, which compiles down to JavaScript. And to be honest, I don't 100% understand it yet either. And that's okay. But what I really like about it is when I was in college, I learned a little bit of OCaml and I didn't understand at all why anyone would ever do this. And then I learned about functional programming and I realized why people choose to do OCaml. And then I put that aside for years. And now this comes out and all of a sudden I have all that knowledge coming back and saying, oh, now that I see it in practice, I can fully understand or more fully understand why someone would choose to make a language that compiles down to OCaml and get the entire OCaml ecosystem. And still, it feels a lot like JavaScript. So front-end developers have a sense of familiarity. And if I hadn't had that previous knowledge, I would look at Reason today and say, I don't understand why anyone's doing this. But as a result of kind of looking back to a language that's, 40, 50 years old and being able to go to the roots of something, I'm able today to more easily understand why something is interesting or might be useful to learn or might be useful to ignore even.
So I've never heard of OCaml before. I actually did a Google search for it. The thing that I kind of gleaned real quick was I saw something that said OCaml versus Haskell. So is it a functional language?
Yeah, it's a functional language. It's not as pure as Haskell. So in Haskell, everything has to be pure. And you create abstract concepts like monads or other Haskell-y things that I don't remember, like endofunctors and very fancy math terms. OCaml is a much more reasonable approach to someone who doesn't have like a pure mathematical background or can view code as a pure mathematical abstraction. And yeah, I mean, actually, a lot of the stuff that people use is built in OCaml, specifically around compilers. OCaml is a very common language to use for building a compiler, and a lot of the tools at Facebook are built in OCaml for that reason.
Interesting. Yeah, I saw C being referenced alongside of OCaml, so it'll get kind of low level there, I guess.
I can't really say how C interacts with OCaml. I don't know offhand, but I imagine it's built in C, and that's probably why. But
okay, that would make sense.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's not that low level of language. It's actually object oriented, even. Which, the time that it was created, that's what the O in OCaml stands for. At the time it was created, it was a pretty new concept, the idea of object-oriented programming. And actually, while we're on the subject, it's actually interesting to kind of take a step back and say Objective-C, which is the language that iOS developer used before Swift, is built on the ideas that Smalltalk presented. Smalltalk being the language that Alan Kay invented at Xerox PARC, which is where they built the mouse, the GUI, and all the things that you find in modern day Macs. And then Objective-C was made to be a layer that resembled Smalltalk in this object-oriented style on top of C. And then Steve Jobs took Objective-C and built Next, the company that then merged into Apple. And now here we are today with Swift as a result of all of that hard work, the 30 years of building Objective-C. So it's kind of interesting how all the computing history comes together in that way.
Yeah, I've read a bit about the history of Smalltalk and Objective-C, and it very very interesting. Smalltalk was essentially the model for object-oriented programming early on, correct?
Yeah.
And it was kind of interesting to see how Objective-C versus, like, say, C++, because they're both supersets of C, how they kind of implemented those principles differently. With C kind of, or Objective-C, relying on, like, the messaging model and stuff like that, versus, you know, I'm not very well versed in C++ at all, but I don't think that they call them messages whenever you're doing calling functions or anything.
No, it's like a dispatch table. It's actually very similar to the model in Swift. It's pretty interesting that you bring that up, where Alan Kay, the guy who invented Smalltalk, wasn't a programmer. He was a biologist. And what he was trying to do was create a language that more accurately mimicked the way that we interact with each other in a biological sense. And that's how the idea of message passing came to be, as opposed to thinking of bits and bytes for calling functions in C++.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't read that much about Smalltalk to know that it was invented by a non-programmer. That's pretty interesting. Because hearing about the messaging model when I first came across hearing about messages, and I think that my understanding of it is very rudimentary at best. But is it similar to the way messages are passed, like, say, on an operating system kernel level, where it's like there's essentially like a I don't want to say an inbox, but that is how I've heard of it referenced when sending. And I'm thinking of the model where you're sending messages between processes.
Yeah, there's similarity there. Like, I think that's more akin to the actor model, which is what you find in Erlang. But at the same time, you have this runtime. And the runtime registers a whole bunch of functions that it can be called, or that can be called to it. And, you know, in Objective-C, when you message nil, it just does nothing. And that's kind of the idea of failing gracefully. But, you know, that leads to a whole bunch of errors around messaging nil that you don't catch in real time. But it's kind of like shouting into the void. You know, if no one's sitting next to me and I just yell, no one hears it, nothing happens. And so Objective-C took that idea, and that's kind of how message passing works in principle.
Which actually makes sense if you think of it on that, using that mental model instead of thinking of calling a function on something that is exactly. that is not there. It's not that it's like sending a letter to a non-existent address. It still goes out, might come back to you. But I mean, that this metaphor is going to break down horribly very quickly.
Yeah, how you handle the errors is up to you.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that makes a lot more sense to me now. So that's cool. Are there any other, I've heard of, from other podcasts, I've actually heard of people that are kind of keeping Smalltalk alive, essentially. I forget what they're calling it, but have you looked at any of that kind of stuff where people are still programming in Smalltalk and like doing fun little things with it?
You know, I actually don't really follow along with Smalltalk that much, but it is history and it's really important context to understanding where we are today. And so I like to read a lot about a lot of things, but I don't necessarily like to do a lot of things because my time is limited. So I try and focus on the things that I can do and take the concepts that I've learned by reading or trying to digest something else and apply it to the work that I do. So I work predominantly in Swift. I like to dabble in other languages, but I don't necessarily have the time or energy to focus all my work on those things. But I do think it's important to, we have a lot of, not invented here syndrome in programming sometimes, where you'll remake the entire world just to fix one thing. And I think it's really important to avoid that because time and energy are probably, you know, the most finite resources that we have. And so I like to keep abreast with a lot of things, but not necessarily focus on or feel like I'm missing out by not doing those things.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's, the fear of missing out, I think, is something that probably a lot of new developers feel whenever they see all these other technologies and wondering if, you know, should I focus on this? Maybe should I try this out? You know, and I think early on, I kind of had this experience where I was like, well, I feel like I need to know this and need to know this. And if I don't, maybe I'm not choosing the right path for me. Eventually I just, you know, iOS has always been something that, you know, since I started learning to program, is something that I've focused on and wanted to do. But I kind of, as far as the, other things in the periphery, I don't want to say shut those out. I still pay attention to them, but I'm not actively, I'm not using it to take up my time. I guess a better way to put it would be I'm not sacrificing the time that I have available to develop and, you know, get better at Swift and iOS in favor of those. But I'll still, like, when I have, like, you know, I'm a new father. So, like, sometimes when I'm feeding my daughter or holding her or something, I might read a blog post or something about something non-Swift related. But when I actually have time to sit down, I'm probably not going to focus on those things, because at that time, you know, I can't really do anything Swift related anyway, because I'm holding a little baby.
Sure. No, first of all, congratulations. That's amazing. And,
thank you.
I'm really excited to hear that. I'll also say that I still feel that almost every day. It's not a thing that went away as I became more senior. It's a thing that I work hard to tamp down, the idea that I may be choosing a path that I'm not as interested in, or I may be, you know, that fear of missing out is real. But part of it is actually, as I continue to do iOS after, you know, 8-9 years, I feel like I, at this point, have a PhD in iOS. Like, I know all the nooks and crannies and things that make it weird and special and terrible and awesome. But also, the ways that I can express myself are more and more limited, partially due to the way the market works and partially due to the fact that there's just not that much left to explore. And so I would like to rekindle that feeling of what does it feel like to not know something and then now know it. And it's like, the reason I say I feel like I have a PhD is I never wanted to be the person who knew 95% about a subject rather than 80%, because the diminishing returns of going from 95 to 96, 96 to 97 are as hard as it is to go from, you know, 60 to 80%. And so I like to look around. I like to think that Swift will evolve in ways that I will be able to use it, not just for building iOS apps. And so I've started building Swift on the server stuff, and I'm really excited to see Swift for TensorFlow and other projects evolving around that. And there's going to be some time before it's all ready. And so, you know, that's part of the reason that I like to keep in touch with other things, because there are advancements happening everywhere. And it's really good in the meantime to bring them back to my daily work, but also not to leave out the option of actually doing, you know, as hopefully the front end world on the web settles down, doing stuff there, learning more about backend, not just doing Swift, then other languages as well, but you know, taking that time to make that real commitment to learning something in depth. And to circle back, that fear never goes away. It's just a matter of working hard to feel balanced the way that you want to feel balanced. That might be, for some people, going all in on something different. And for some people, it might be just keeping in touch. But whatever makes you happy is what's important.
Pretty good advice, I think, there. You had mentioned that you had dabbled with some server-side Swift. Do you have a preferred framework? Because I know that there's really, I know there's more than, but you know, usually when you think of server-side Swift, you're either thinking of Vapor, Katura, or Perfect. And I think there's maybe one or two others. They just don't have as much popularity in the community that I'm aware of anyway. Do you have a preferred one, or do you have any pros and cons for each one if you've dived into more than one?
Sure. Now that Swift NIO is out, it actually seems easier to build your own web framework if that was the thing that you wanted to do. And I know the people who make pointfree.co have built their own web framework ostensibly around Swift. I think it's Swift Neo, actually. And my preferred framework is Vapor. I'm not dogmatic about it. I just really like the abstractions that they've built out. The routing layer is really nice. It uses Codable. It uses an async model for promises, which I think are a really good model, both on the server side and on the client side. And now that Vapor has reached Vapor 3, it's a lot more stable than it once was. It was kind of a moving target in terms of a platform. But I think that the other frameworks that I've tried are, they feel a little not Swifty. They feel like direct ports of like an Express model, or they just feel that they're kind of a little outdated in the way that I would like to be writing Swift. And so currently I use Vapor, but I'm not dogmatic in saying that I prescribe this as the only solution.
Yeah, I've used Vapor a little bit too. I was, you know, anytime that you need need some kind of back-end web service for an application, it's kind of like, well, do I use one of these back-end as a service tools what's it called? The Google one.
Firebase.
Yeah, I was going to call it Fireside, but that's the name of the podcast host I use. it's like a choice between that. Parse is open source, so you could ostensibly run your own Parse server. But at the end of the day, I kind of feel like not having my data on a Google owned backend, which is just my personal thing. I would prefer to take complete ownership over it, and then also, if there was some success, not have to pay more than like say $15 a month for whatever kind of server that I'm running. But anyway, so I dabbled in Vapor, and one of the things that I really like about Vapor is their Fluent package for dealing with SQL databases.
Yeah,
and using all the Swift key paths, the way that you can do your query filters and stuff like that is so nice. Like, I wish it was on iOS, because you can use SQLite with it, but I was looking at a bunch of, I had thought about wonder if I could just use this, because I was using CoreData, and then I was looking at Realm to see if, like, because CoreData, I like CoreData. You know, it's the platform.
I don't. That's okay.
Well, when I say I like CoreData, I mean that, like, so when one of the issues that I hit with Realm when I was considering using it is that whenever you want to do if you want to do table view sections, mm-hmm. you've got your Realm is great. I'm not bashing Realm in any way. I think it has a lot of nice features. Having their whole reactive model for dealing with changes to your result set. Mm-hmm. So you query something from Realm, and then if something changes that matches that essentially that result set, it'll automatically, you know, you'll get a notification for it. You can react to it, like, and it's very clean. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's like an NS Fetch results controller from Apple.
Exactly. Exactly what it's like. But the one problem with it, and it's been an open issue for I think almost 2 years now, getting grouped results and having those in like a table view with sections. So one thing that I need in my application. And you can't essentially, so whenever you go with different sections, then you have to come up with a really hacky way to do it. And I was kind of on that path, but then I was just like, you know what, like having to do this to do something that I kind of already have implemented with CoreData is not really the road I want to go down.
Yeah. So the way that I think about it is that CoreData and Realm solve very, very similar problems. It's the same group of problems that they're solving. And then there is another approach, which is my preferred approach, which is you have Swift models that you persist either in memory or to disk, rather than building up a model graph that Realm and CoreData are really good at. And that's never been my preferred solution for the idea of just offline support. It is a very specific kind of problem that you're trying to solve. Something that's like where you need faulting, for example, would be the perfect solution for CoreData. But that's not my preferred approach for pretty much every iOS app's version of persistence.
So would you mind sharing your approach? Because this is something that I've kind of been struggling with, the complexity of core data with the relationships, because mm-hmm. one of the things that I've found is that whenever you have relationships, so you've got all your faults, like you said. So whenever you fetch something, initially you get them as faults. So then if it's a fault, when you access it, I think it goes down to the row cache, if I'm not mistaken. And then if it's not in the row cache, then it has to go down to the actual persistent store and then traverse all the way mm-hmm. back up the stack. And then if you've got a relationship, it does the same thing. And if it's a set, it does two faults. You've got the set where you just get the fault for the set. And then when you access that, then that is fulfilled. But then when you access an object, there's another. So it you can run into some performance issues depending on how your model's created. And, you know, maybe my model's just not as efficient as it should be.
Yeah. So the way that I usually approach it is I use, I'll try and find the name of the library, but the idea of using a cache that both saves to memory and disk. So for accessing, I access from memory, and then for saving for persistence for offline, I save to disk. And the way that it works is you build your app the same way that you would build it as if it didn't have offline support, if it was just, you know, an app that's in the App Store. And it used to be harder. You would try and make objects that are conforming to NS coding. And actually, that didn't work with structs. So I would have an intermediate layer where the struct would convert to an object and the object would get saved. And when you retrieve it, you get a version of that as a struct. And that's a ton of boilerplate. But now, thanks to Codable, you can just conform to Codable and have this cache save that object to disk. The only thing that it doesn't solve is doing the fault tolerance, like you said, kind of lookups and accesses. But the nice thing about doing a two-tiered approach where you use memory and disk is that anything that you write to disk, and anything that you read from memory. So as long as your object graph that you're trying to access isn't hundreds of megabytes, or, you know, I would say probably tens of thousands of objects in all likelihood, then you should be fine. You won't feel any of the pain of that you would in terms of reading from disk, since it's coming from memory. And you can do searches, you can do filters, you can do queries and all that kind of stuff using NS sort descriptors and all that.
Interesting, that because that's really kind of this, and the really big issue that I have, my biggest gripe about core data and Realm for that matter is how unswifty they feel. They don't feel totally. Like when, because especially if that's what you're relying, when you've got your model that's pretty much it's all reliant on Objective-C data types, it makes your code very hard. It just feels clunky whenever you're writing this code. And to make it feel swifty, you have to do a lot of I don't want to say weird, but you've got to write these abstractions to make it feel a little more swifty. So I definitely think I might check that out, because for my situation, I don't see there being tens of thousands of objects in memory at any time. It's really, and the objects themselves are very simple. They're pretty much just data, just your regular data types, just combined in a way that makes sense to present to the user. So yeah, I might check that out, because that's really interesting to me, because that's one of the reasons why I like Fluent so much, is because it feels swifty. It feels nice to write you know, queries and stuff like that. So anything that I could find to use on the client side on iOS would be amazing. So definitely give me the when you get the mm-hmm. library, whatever it is that you're using, I'll put it in the show notes, and I definitely want to take a look at that.
You bet. There's actually a great quote from Gary Bernhardt, the programmer. He says, "Reminder to people whose quote unquote big data is under a terabyte. Servers with 1 terabyte of RAM can be had at about 20K. Your data set fits in RAM." And it's funny, because he's actually trying to say, like, we build around all these abstractions, but really just throwing whatever in RAM and doing your searches and your queries and all that stuff there is going to be even faster. And it's just going to be way simpler of a mental model as a programmer. You won't have to maintain this abstraction, or you won't have to create this kind of, like you said, working with Objective-C objects in your Swift app and unforeseen assumptions about how things work. Just throw it in memory. If you can afford it, throw it in memory. And in this case, instead of money, it's just RAM.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. So, yeah. Awesome. That actually makes me very happy. I'm glad I brought you on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, Joe, we are kind of coming up on time, but is there anything that you want to talk about before we sign off?
So, yeah, there's one last thing, which is that there's no silver bullet in programming. Programming is all gray area, and it's pretty rarely black and white. So part of the reason that I focus on ethics and philosophy and computing history is to understand that these abstractions and these ideas exist for a reason, and that the most important thing you can do is consider others and then use your own head when you're considering others. There won't be one pattern that saves you from everything. And it's good to be knowledgeable about all of these things, but it's not because that thing is the answer. It's because you'll know when to use the right answer for the right problem.
That's I don't think I can add anything to that. I think that was just a perfect statement.
Cool.
Yeah. So, is there anything else that you want to speak to?
No,
before we sign off?
No, I'm all right.
Okay, cool. So Joe, if anybody wants to reach out to you, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure. My Twitter handle is MergeSort, MergeSort. And I say a lot of things on there. Some things that I probably will regret in the future, but you know, it is what it is and that's life. And, yeah, you can reach out to me. I'm the same handle on pretty much every platform, except for Reddit, where someone stole my username, but whatever. I don't care. It's whatever.
Yeah, I guess you probably got on early on because, I mean, that's a common sorting algorithm, right?
It's actually funny. I had a different Twitter handle years ago, and I needed something more professional, let's say. And it was probably 3 or 4 years into Twitter's existence. And so I wanted a Radix sort, and I wanted a whole bunch of other things, and they were all taken. And I settled on Merge sort because I still don't even know how to do that off the top of my head, to be honest. It was the only thing remaining, and I guess I'm pretty happy the way that it all worked out.
There you go, the least favorite algorithm, but still an algorithm.
Yeah.
sorry.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. And. Everyone, you can reach me on Twitter, of course, at Steven_0351. The show has a Twitter as well, at LearnSwift_FM. The website is LearnSwift.fireside.fm. And just want to remind everyone that the Learn Swift podcast is part of the Greater Swift Coders Network of podcasts. And, you know, you can check out Garrick's episodes on Swift Coders and Zach and Steve on Fireside Swift and E-Man on Swiftcraft. Check those guys out if you haven't done so already. Hey, Joe, thanks for coming on the show. It was a real pleasure having you on.
Yeah, thank you. I had a great time. Looking forward to talking to you soon.